Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital. I'm here today with Tim Johnson. Tim is the senior pastor at Orlando World Outreach Center. And prior to that, he had a career in the NFL. If you could see his biceps, you would understand where those come from. During his career, you won a Super Bowl.
Yes.
With the Washington Redskins. You don't wear it?
I don't wear it too often. It's cumbersome and it draws too much attention.
Well, then I can't try it on, but well, one of these days you can do that.
I will.
You and I became connected because of your passion and my passion for, and it's even broader than this, but men and women behind bars. Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited to hear what you're doing in this stage of your life around that. So welcome.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where'd you grow up? Where you went to school, and then just high level of your career.
Born and raised in Sarasota, Florida, just 2 hours south of here, rated some of the best beaches in the world. left high school, went to Penn State University on a football scholarship. And after Penn State, I was drafted by the Steelers. I was there for 3 years and then was traded to then the Washington Redskins, where my second year with the Redskins, we won the Super Bowl. And then my 10th year, I finished with the Cincinnati Bengals. I was a free agent. And so closed out my career in Cincinnati. I have 4 children, a wife, and I say this, but I don't say it to patronize people. I have more than I ever deserved in my family. They're some of the most beautiful, dynamic people I know. And my wife is still my girlfriend. She's beautiful in every way. And so I'm grateful and humbled by the gifts that the Father has given me and my family.
When my wife listens to this, she's going to pick out that line that you just said about 20 seconds ago. And we've been married 26 years.
Oh, wow.
And if there's one thing that I could continue to do better and better, it's that whole idea of courtship, dating, even at 26
right.
years. So I appreciate that. So then after you left the NFL, what'd you do?
I was headed to law school. I had arranged to have a mentor at George Mason mentor me and begin the preparation for the LSAT. And I was just going to go into law because I wanted to be a judge. I had thought through and looked at the landscape of cities and communities. And I felt like one of the hinges on the door that locks people out or lets them in to public life, to mainstream life, was in the courtroom. So much happens in the courtroom that we overlook mm-hmm. because we're looking at all the issues on the streets. Part of the system of depleting the humanity of underprivileged people happens actually in the courtroom. The system is built in a way where you lack a lot of resources, which means you lack a lot of opportunities. So you have limited choices. And many of those limited choices include illegal activity. And so it's generational. And I don't think anyone's born and looks forward to being incarcerated. I just can't wait to spend 20 years in prison. Mm-hmm. That's my life goal. I think it's something that is seen and caught and taught and experienced. And so I thought there's a way to actually pivot people in different directions in the courtroom. So that was my ambition. But they say if you want to make God laugh, show him your plans. He saw my plans for law school, and there was a belly laugh in heaven. And he sent me to Nashville, where I became a pastor at Bethel World Outreach Church in Brentwood, Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And we saw an amazing work, many, many miracles, the dynamic of the congregation and the people. We went from about 800 people to 3,000 multiple congregations. And then in 2006, he spoke to me and said, Orlando. And I was just here on vacation. I wasn't planning to plant a church in Orlando. Been here many, many years on vacation. Didn't even know people lived here, really. I thought everybody was on vacation.
Right.
And he said, plant a church here. In 2007, we started that journey and we're still here 16 years later.
Okay, so I got to stop for a second. You went from potentially becoming a lawyer, working with predominantly, I'm assuming, poor, underprivileged, and then you moved to Brentwood. Now, maybe I have a misperception of Brentwood, but I don't picture those two being equal. So that's quite a transition. You got to at least tell us how that transition happened quickly.
My goal was to, in pursuing a legal career, it was to represent whomever needed help, but have a benevolent outlet to assist people that would normally have assistance in those expertise. There's legal aid in a lot of places that we work with now, but to be a part of the game, so to speak, for me, it wasn't my choice. It actually wasn't my choice to go to Nashville. Mm-hmm. I was going to be in Virginia. I had retired. I was involved. I was going into law school, but I was also involved in the Redskins organization. I was doing some traveling around the country. My family was settled. We're not done until the Father's will is done. And he wasn't done with me just yet, making my own decisions. He led us to go to Nashville because there was a church there in Brentwood where it was started by a businessman trading advertising for radio time to preach the Bible.
Okay.
And it was the Lord's Chapel, and it became this thing in Brentwood. Right around the time I was going there, around 2000, a year or so before, Dr. Rice Brooks, I don't know if you've ever heard of God's Not Dead, the movies, the books.
Absolutely. Okay.
Dr. Rice wrote all those books and was involved in the movies. He and I worked together. So when he took over, he wanted to actually have a congregation that was multi-ethnic in Brentwood. And so we had 7 billboards around Nashville. And I don't know if you know I-65 in Nashville, right outside of Brentwood. There's a statue there of Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was, I guess, one of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan, and a half moon of Confederate flags. So that was the thing that loomed in the shadows of Brentwood. So what we thought was exalt a standard greater than the standard of division that still lingers in the minds of people, not so outwardly as it once was. So we put 7 billboards up. The very first billboard back in those days you would see coming out of Nashville was of a black hand and a white hand just like this. And it was reaching a city to touch the world. And we literally saw that congregation in Brentwood go from predominantly white to thousands of all kinds of ethnic. It was a miracle. I don't know that we understood the significance of it. We were just in it. We were in it deep. I mean, we were working hard, laboring, praying, having meetings, seeing, going to visit homes. We were doing all kinds of stuff. It was the Father's calling me to be a part of a spectacle of his grace to bring healing to a city, reconciliation. Then me saying, oh, let's go to Nashville. That was the last place I would have picked.
Well, I'm going to go back one more notch and then we'll move forward. For those who are NFL fans and whatnot, and I'm trying to think the best question. I don't know if this is the best question, but here's what I'm going to ask you. From a worldly perspective, you're in the NFL, you win a Super Bowl. That's probably the height of the mountain for most people. Mm-hmm. What was it like being at the height of the mountain, and how quickly did you come down and how did you adjust?
I never dreamed that big as a kid. I could never dream that big because there were so many other things to confront and face. As I got a little older, you know, it was maybe. And as kids, we used to pretend to be Bob Greasy and Mercury Morris and Paul Warfield. And because I lived in Florida, it was the Dolphins. And then, you know, later on, it began the 70s. It was the Buccaneers when they came to town. And so we were always fantasizing, but it was never a reality that I would play football in the NFL. I was just trying to accomplish whatever was in front of me at the time. And so as I walked through life and saw I had some potential, I was going from junior high to high school when a stranger sat me down. Still to this day, I have no idea where this man came from.
Wow.
He said, you can be different. So he's giving me this speech. I'm nobody. Hmm. You can be different. And he said, you have to have determination, motivation, discipline, and perseverance. Wow. I didn't really know what those things meant. I was just trying to figure out the next day. And something clicked. And so I started to actually make determinations of what I wanted to do. I want to play sports. Okay, I'll start there. Be motivated to do it. Don't wait for somebody to tell me what to do. Be disciplined to stop doing some things and start focusing. And then never give up. And so as I walk through this journey, all of a sudden, now I'm getting pretty good. And I'm in college, I'm in high school, I'm like really seeing this is real. Getting to the Super Bowl was another planet. Winning the Super Bowl was out of this stratosphere because it's so rare, out of the thousands. And then to have the humbling privilege of having a national championship and a Super Bowl, that puts me in a very exclusive club of athletes that have one of each. And I was an All-American in college. And in 93, I was Sports Illustrated All-Pro. So I know I don't look like much, but that that actually happened in my life. And I scratched my own head like, this is amazing. So to be at that level was beyond anything I could have ever expected or even dreamed of. I think there's two ways to answer that question, though. One is a life that's lived for the kingdom because Christ Jesus saved you, or a life lived for this world. If I answered it based on this world, I can tell you it was empty, 100% empty. But because of what Christ had done for me and in me, when I went into the NFL, he told me to prepare to leave. My first year in the NFL, I was leaving, which allowed me to enjoy it more because I did not live for this to be forever. So I didn't become my identity. So for me, it became a joy. It was an experience of a lifetime. It was so rare to have these things to talk about and these experiences to share and relationships that opened up that many of them still remain, or some of them still remain. And so I think there's two ways to answer it. I would say it was a joy for me because I didn't try to hold on to it too long.
I don't know why. There's several things over the last month or so where you talk about these mountaintop experiences and they're wonderful like that, but they're not meant to be up there for that long. The air is thin, enjoy it while you're there, and it can be a lonely place. And yet on the other hand, I am sure that gets you into the door to a lot of places today that I will never get into. And so you use it. You use it for your benefit.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
That's how I use my Super Bowl national championship ring. When I go to high schools or places where people want me to speak, I'll pull those out and I'll say to people, you'll probably never see this in your life again. Because many of them won't see a national championship ring and a Super Bowl ring in the same person's hand.
Yeah.
So it's a novelty.
You've lived a lot of life and you've probably got some wounds like we all do. You've got mountaintop and I know some of the stuff you're doing today. So how would you best describe who you are today in the context of where you are in your journey, in your life journey?
It's very simple for me. I am loved. It's my whole identity. I am loved as a son by his father. Whatever the highest mountain is on earth won't be my highest experience because every day I live with my greatest reward, and it's my father's love. It's his presence in my life, that he would ever say anything to me, that he would let me feel his presence. That is my greatest reward, more than my family, more than any money I have, any material thing. He is my greatest reward. So my identity is not in what he calls me to do. As amazing and as wild as the ride gets, that I get to do it with him, that he asked me to do it. There is nothing greater for me than him. It might be underwhelming, but my identity is I'm loved.
I'm assuming you are talking at a spiritual level here.
100%.
Okay, so let's go down the natural side for a second. Mm-hmm. Somebody who's listening who didn't have that in the natural sense, how do you answer that?
I was that. That was my life. I'm 58 years old and have accomplished a lot of things. But what I found out is so much of what I was came from what I did. I was a football player, or I was best all around. I was prom king. I was an All-American. You know, I was, based on the executive director of the Boys Club, I was a role model. I was a lot of different things and was successful at some of them. And so it would have been easy to be trapped with my identity in those things as the reason for my existence, as the source of my existence. The only problem is those things change. Those things adjust. Yep. I change. And so now I'm in a constant fight to try to figure out, who do I belong to? What do I really believe? And how should I behave? It's easy to see, look back and see how easy it was to just follow the success I was having. That's just easy. And it's natural to do so. I'm not saying it's wrong to do so. The problem is, it won't satisfy the deepest longing of our hearts. I know that story too, because while being a success, I know what it felt like to be lonely. I know what it felt like to have issues in your soul in the middle of the night that you really don't want people to know, because they might treat you different. They might see you different. And so we live behind these masks that cover so much of what we really want to talk about, we really want, we really need. And what does a man desire? Most of all, Proverbs says, is everlasting love. The only way to find everlasting love is to find who is everlasting. That's with Christ. I didn't find Jesus, by the way. I didn't find love. I didn't. A lot of people say, well, I found God. I did not find him. I would never tell anyone that he found me. I would never boast as if somehow I got some kind of intellect where I figured it out. As spiritually, I was just dumb as a box of rocks. And morally, I was a mess. I was a mess because I had success and I had people telling me who I was and all these things, but they weren't there for me to talk to at midnight, 1 a.m, when I'm trying to figure out, why am I on this piece of dirt called planet Earth, this thing spinning in space, for what? Why am I here? Who am I? These thoughts used to hit my head as a teenager. I had no answers.
As you're talking, it makes me think of The Last Dance with Michael Jordan. Mm-hmm. And when I watch it, I lived in Chicago, so that I was in all of that. But you see a man who longs for his father's love. Mm-hmm. You can see that throughout the whole thing. So there's so much truth to what you're saying. How are you trying to change the world? And maybe this is a natural spot to talk about how you and I met and what you're working on.
Yeah.
But if you want to answer differently, you sure can.
Yeah, no. I think so much of what changing the world looks like comes from what the creator has to say about what change looks like. Cause I have a lot of ideas myself. When I was in Virginia, I had a 3-year and a 5-year plan. And I had descriptions of an organization that would house a lot of different services for different people groups. And it was a lot that I had planned. But at the end of the day, we can inspire one another, but we cannot transform one another. And so any plan to change the world starts with me desiring to hear from the Spirit of God, what are you up to? What are you doing? And what part do you want me to play? Because it's going to take all of us to have a light that shines bright enough to dismiss the darkness and overshadow the darkness. So the part that he gave me was, I was praying March of 2022, and I said, Father, show me the secrets of your heart, because I know my heart can't change anybody. But if it's in your heart, it's already done. And it's the only power that's going to change the human heart. And he says, Rikers Island. So besides the church that I do, we're planning a church in Sweden. I speak in different countries and do a lot of things to speak and bring life. That's one of the things that I'm passionate about as well. He says, Rikers Island.
Did you have any knowledge or history of Rikers Island?
No history of Rikers Island. I don't think I've ever said the name out of my mouth, but I thought it was a prison and I thought it was closed. So when I heard the thought, when the Holy Spirit impressed upon me those words, Rikers Island, and I began to Google, I was hopeful that I was right, that it was closed, mm-hmm. that it was a prison, it was a bygone thing. And I was wrong. Read an article. I don't think I finished the article about how it was one of the worst jails in the world and all these issues and it's going to close, blah, blah, blah. And so I kind of settled back into prayer and he said, you're going to go there. And I'm summarizing. You're going to go there and here's what's going to happen. As I'm sitting here, it's over almost March will be 2 years now. Everything he told me, he has done. 1 week, that was a Saturday, March 12th. That next Saturday, I got on a plane with a one-way ticket because I had to know, am I losing my mind? Am I imagining? Or, Father, is this you really speaking to me by your spirit? Got on a plane. I told my wife and kids, who they agreed to let me go. I said, I got to find out. 12 days after that, 12 is the number of government. I was standing on Rikers Island, and it was an absolute miracle how I got on that island. And from that day, the miracles have not stopped. I got there and introduced the Fatherless No More initiative. June 13th, landed in an RV with Art Monk, and I lived on Rikers Island for 5 months implementing the initiative, and it's unearthly, it's unexplainable what has happened in that jail.
We could go on and on, and obviously there's a deep passion of mine. So, but let's start with them to ask just a couple questions. Fatherless No More, articulate that a little bit more.
That came from my roommate. Okay. My college roommate was DJ Dozier, running back, one of the first guys to actually play professional baseball and football. A lot of people think of Bo Jackson, Tim Tebow. DJ was one of the first.
Okay. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. We were at a banquet 5 years ago supporting one of our teammates who was doing ministry in Pennsylvania. I did I spoke. The banquet's clearing. We're all there. He's standing there and he says to me, Tim, you're going to write that book. And I was not thinking about writing a book. I've had many people recommend you write a book and it's good. It's a nice idea. I hear it, but I'm not just wanting to follow good ideas. I got to know if it's what the Father's saying. I've ignored many people that says you ought to write a book. So when he says you're going to write that book, and I'm thinking, oh, okay, one more person to ignore.
Right, right.
And then he says, I have a title. And I'm like, okay, what is it? And he says, Fatherless No More. I almost fell on the ground. It struck my heart. And I've not stopped in 5 years. Thinking, planning, preparing. The book should be finished next year. So will the documentary film, Fatherless No More, Rikers Island. The book will be Fatherless No More, pretty much my story. It was birthed again in a divine way. And I have not had a plan for any of this, but I have had a yes to do this. And if you think about it, the root of destruction in our world today is fatherlessness. You give me a social, economic, a social indicator anywhere in any country, and in it, you will find the root of fatherlessness. Whether it's crime, domestic violence, wars, poverty, incarceration, you know this story as well as I do. The root hell itself is fatherlessness, because the first one who became fatherless was Lucifer. And ever since then, he's wanted to pull us away from the source of our existence and give us every other reason to exist, then he can fill the gap. he can be the one who steps in between and creates the destruction, the chaos, the confusion, the darkness, and the death that he does, because we've been distracted by all these reasons for our existence. And when Jesus came, he closed the gap and crushed the enemy and says, I'm not going to leave you as orphans. I will never leave you. He came to bring us back to the Father so we can be healed, whole, and restored back to the reason for our existence.
I think we just had a little sermon. that was great. All right. So then for our female listeners, how do they, this fatherless no more as a female, how do they think about that?
I would love to know from them directly, but I had three daughters. And so, and a wife. And what I know from dealing and working with females is the needs we all have innately are three things. And I mentioned them a few minutes ago. We have a need to know who we belong to. We have a need to know what to believe. And we have a need to know how to behave. The unfortunate thing is a lot of society is focused on behavior. Trying to do behavior modification, trying to counsel behavior and provide reasons for it. That's fine. But what I found, and I'll take you back to Rikers. You know what I did? I went in there and it was chaos. It was, you talking about a dark experience? Oh my goodness. Spend 10 hours a day with guys who are murderers and conspiracy to commit murder and violence. That's all they know. I plopped right down in the middle of them. And the behavior was atrocious. I never corrected their behavior unless it was extreme.
Right.
You know what I did first? I gave them a reason to believe they belong to me. When they're in my nine, you belong to me, without correcting anything. And when the walls of trust that I didn't have some secret agenda, I fed them, taught them skills, communication, team building, learning their story. And out of building a bridge, when they begin to trust, hey, you're for real. Like, you really do love us. You really, after all the nonsense, it got so bad one day. It was so bad. They were disrespecting me so bad. And I think it was out there. They was just testing me.
Right.
I know. I sat back in the chair and I said, you know what, guys? I get respected all over the world. Everywhere I go, anywhere in the world I go, except for here. Except for here. And I think it shook the room a little bit because I didn't yell and scream. I was giving them a reason to feel safe with me and to believe they can trust me. When you come to women, that more than anything is what a woman is looking for. I need a safe place. Someone who's not going to violate me, someone who's going to affirm me, someone who's going to accept me and my humanity, whether male or female, but especially for females, to actually invest in me as a human being, valued. So for me, fatherlessness for women is as critical as it is for men, because a lot of the trouble women face are as a result of fatherless men. Mm-hmm. If I don't see a man, how am I going to know what a man looks like? If I'm seeing trouble and abuse, that's the cycle I live in. Mm-hmm. The times I've been able to engage with women, with other women and in groups, it's been transformative for them to feel safe with a man who's making an introduction to them to the Father through the Son, who comes to forgive them and free them from this place of behavior and unbelief. Because once you know you belong to the Father, now you want to know what to believe. That will change your behavior.
When did you realize the power of capital? And it'd be interesting to hear what you say, because you've been around it in different, it is purposely, power of capital is broad, so you can answer however you want. When did you realize the power of capital, and what does that mean to you?
The greatest capital that I have seen is access. It's access to information and experiences when I was in high school, I had gotten a scholarship to Penn State. And a friend of mine, a childhood friend of mine's dad, introduced me to this doctor, Dr. Aaron Mattis. And he lived about 45 minutes from where I lived, like way across town. But he had this system of stretching and his, you know, physical training that was second to none. This guy invited me into his house and personally trained me before I went to Penn State. Mm. I was in the best shape of my life. I didn't use any money. All he did was give me time and access mm-hmm. and exposure. That to me was the capital that opened up. I played my freshman year. I lettered at Penn State 4 years. So much of that foundation. Now I had worked like a dog up to that point, but I needed something to get me to the next level. And this was the key. He never gave me money. They did feed me after the workout because I work out 3-4 hours a night.
Wow.
You know, so to me, that was the power of capital.
Yep.
Because money comes and goes. But when you give someone time and access and information and exposure to what they, so I've tried to do that for people and I've given tons of money, but I've tried to do what was done for me. And that's what's happening at Rikers. I don't go give these guys money. I give them access to information and experiences that relates to not where they've been. They know where they've been, but where they can go.
What does stewardship mean to you?
Oh, that's easy. The Father owns it all. And whatever I have, it's not really mine. It's really not mine. In the moment I become possessive, then it possesses me.
Yeah. Well, you even go back to your NFL experience. Mm-hmm. You didn't let it own you.
One of the challenges of making millions of dollars is tithing. Like, give a 10%. What? It was a great joy for me to, I mean, I gave lots of money and went beyond the tithe to actually sow into starting the Good Samaritan Foundation, me and some of my teammates, and doing so many other things. I felt like he is no fool to give up what he can't keep to get what he can't lose. Mm-hmm. And we've heard that before, but it's true.
All right, we're going to end with this. And you can leave your family out of this just because everybody wants to answer it this way. If you can't, then you can answer it this way. But if you could have one dream come true in your life between now and the end of your life, what would it be?
If I wasn't a pastor, I would still answer this way. I want to see an awakening. I want to see an awakening in my lifetime, an awakening, a real awakening.
And what do you mean awakening for those listening?
When you look at the world and the state of entropy it's in, we're going from a state of creation where there was order to more and more disorder. People are being intoxicated with death, murder, mass shootings. Like, we are falling off the map and things are unraveling. So in my mind, it's like gravity. Everything's being pulled down. Darkness. An awakening is thrust and lift. It's the law of aerodynamics. It's something that violates the natural order of the destruction that we see. And it's supernatural. It's the Holy Spirit of God coming to awaken people to the image they were created for, rather than the destruction of the image they were created for. And so I want to see an awakening where people are awakened to the possibilities of freedom, forgiveness, love, faith in Christ, eternal life, living to live again, being able to serve one another and see wholeness and restoration in our community instead of murder. You used to be able to go to communities or cities and say, the crime's over here. Stay away from here. They're grocery stores now, churches. It's everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You don't have to give us any dates, but next year maybe you'll have a book out, maybe a documentary out.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That's the strong sense that we have right now.
Okay. I will make sure that people get directed to however they can learn more about what you're doing. But in my simple words, you were going into one of the toughest jails in the United States, and you're bringing love to them. And it sounds kind of hokey, but I've met one of the guys that was there and who came out, and I've been in many prisons and whatnot across the United States, so this doesn't shock me. But if you met, what was his name?
Michael Bonilla.
So if you met him on the street, you would have no clue that he was a hardened guy 2-3 years ago.
This was last summer he was with us. One of the angriest young men you ever seen sitting in the room. Like, he carried an angry face. You would never know that.
Well, and I just remember one of the lines that he said, paraphrasing, is, it sounded like you must have gone up, grabbed his face, and said, I love you. Mm-hmm. And I think he said that's the first time he'd ever heard those words.
He said that's the first time a man had ever told him.
Okay.
Mama's always loving their babies.
Yeah.
It's these men, we actually need to be present in these dark places. They call Rikers Island hell on earth, but I've seen heaven touch hell on earth.
For those of you who have listened to podcast with us, if you go back, there's a guy named Akash Marty. I had him on with Conbody. He actually at one point in his life was in Rikers Island. And if you were to talk to him or talk to any of the guys that you're working with, that smiles, the joy that's in their life. Now, they still have practical issues and things they got to overcome.
Oh, yeah.
Which is obviously some of the stuff that we're going to work on to figure
that's
out
right.
How we give them access to a career and mm-hmm. a new thought and mentors and all that kind of stuff. So thank you so much for your time. And don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. And please rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on the path to a more successful portfolio within the impact investing space. Until next time, I'm Jeff Schaefer. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeff.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.